Chapter 32 Larry woke up at 8:30 to sunlight and the sound of birds. They both freaked him out. Every morning since they had left New York City, sunlight and the sound of birds. And as an extra added attraction, a bonus-free gift, if you like, the air smelled clean and fresh. Even Rita had noticed it. He kept thinking, well, that's as good as it's going to get. But it kept getting better. It got better until you wondered what they had been doing to the planet. And it made you wonder if this was the way the air had always smelled in places like upstate Minnesota and in Oregon and on the western slope of the Rockies. And this morning, in Bennington, Vermont, now headed due east along Highway 9, this morning was something special. It was the by God 4th of July, Independence Day. He sat up in the sleeping bag and looked over at Rita, but she was still out like a light, nothing showing but the lines of her body under the bag's quilted fabric and the fluff of her hair. Well, he would wake her up in style this morning. Larry unzipped his side of the bag and got out, buck naked. For a moment, his flesh marbled into goosebumps, and then the air felt naturally warm, probably 70 already. It was going to be another peach of a day. He crawled out of the little two-man tent and stood up. Parked beside the tent was a 1200cc Harley cycle, black and chrome. Like the sleeping bag and the tent, it had been acquired in Passaic. By that time, they had already gone through three cars, two blocked by terrible traffic jams, the third stuck in the mud outside of Nutley when he had tried to swing around a two-truck smash-up. The bike was the answer. It could be trundled around accidents, pulling itself along in low gear. When the traffic was seriously piled up, it could be ridden along the breakdown lane or the sidewalk, if there was one. Rita didn't like it. Riding Pillion made her nervous, and she clung to Larry desperately. But she had agreed it was the only practical solution. Mankind's final traffic jam had been at Dilley. And since they had left Passaic and gotten into the country, they had made great time. By the evening of July 2nd, they had recrossed into New York State and had pitched their tent on the outskirts of Quarryville, with the hazed and mystic Catskills to the west. They turned east on the afternoon of the 3rd, crossing into Vermont just as dusk fell. And here they were in Bennington. They had camped on a rise outside of town, and now, as Larry stood naked beside the cycle, urinating, he could look down and marvel at the picture postcard New England town below him. Two clean white churches, their steeples rising as if to poke through the blue morning sky. A private school, gray fieldstone buildings shackled with ivy. A mill. A couple of red brick school buildings. Plenty of trees dressed in summer green gowns. The only thing that made the picture subtly wrong was the lack of smoke from the mill and the number of twinkling toy cars parked at weird angles on the main street, which was also the highway they were following. But it's the 4th, he thought. The mill would have been shut down anyway. He cleared his throat, spat, and hummed a little to find his pitch. He drew breath, very much aware of the light morning breeze on his naked chest and buttocks, and burst into song. Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming? He sang it all the way through, facing Bennington, doing a little burlesque bump and grind at the end, because by now Rita would be standing at the flap of the tent, smiling at him. He finished with a snappy salute at the building he thought might be the Bennington courthouse, then turned around, thinking the best way to start another year of independence in the good old U.S. of A. would be with a good old all-American fuck. Larry Underwood, boy patriot, wishes you a very good... But the tent flap was still closed, and he felt a momentary irritation with her. He squashed it resolutely. She couldn't be on his wavelength all the time, that's all. When you could recognize that and deal with it, you were on your way to an adult relationship. He had been trying very hard with Rita since that harrowing experience in the tunnel, and he thought he'd been doing pretty well. You had to put yourself in her place, that was a thing. You had to recognize she was a lot older. She'd been used to having things a certain way for most of her life. It was natural for her to have a harder job adapting to a world that had turned itself upside down. The pills, for instance. He hadn't been overjoyed to discover that she had brought her whole fucking pharmacy along with her in a jelly jar. Yellow jackets, quaaludes, Darvon, and some other stuff that she called my little pick-me-ups. The little pick-me-ups were reds. Three of those with a shot of tequila and you'd jitter and jive all the livelong day. He didn't like it because too many ups and downs and all-arounds added up to one mean monkey on your back, a monkey roughly the size of King Kong. And he didn't like it because when he got right down to where the cheese binds, it was a kind of slap in the face at him, wasn't it? What did she have to be nervous about? Why should she have trouble dropping off at night? He sure as hell didn't. He went back to the tent, then hesitated for a moment. Maybe he ought to let her sleep. Maybe she was worn out, but... He looked down at old Sparky, and old Sparky didn't really want to let her sleep. Singing the old star-speckled banana had turned him right on. So... Rita? And it hit him right away after the fresh morning cleanness of the air outside. He must have been mostly asleep before to have missed it. The smell was not overpoweringly strong because the tent was fairly well ventilated, but it was strong enough. The sweet-sour smell of vomit and sickness. Rita? He felt mounting alarm at the still way she was lying, just that dry fluff of hair sticking out of the sleeping bag. He crawled toward her on his hands and knees, the smell of vomit stronger now, making his stomach knot. Rita, you all right? Wake up, Rita. No movement. So he rolled her over, and the sleeping bag was halfway unzipped as if she'd tried to struggle out of it in the night, maybe realizing what was happening to her, struggling and failing, and he all the time sleeping peacefully beside her, old Mr. Rocky Mountain High himself. He rolled her over, and one of her pill bottles fell out of her hand, and her eyes were cloudy, dull marbles behind half-closed lids, and her mouth was filled with the green puke she had strangled on. He stared into her dead face for what seemed a very long time. They were almost nose to nose, and the tent seemed to be getting hotter and hotter, until it was like an attic on a late August afternoon just before the cooling thunder showers hit. His head seemed to be swelling and swelling. Her mouth was full of that shit. He couldn't take his eyes off that. The question that ran around and around in his brain like a mechanical rabbit on a dog track rail was, how long was I sleeping with her after she died? Repulsive, man. Repulsive. The paralysis broke and he scrambled out of the tent, scraping both knees when they came off the ground sheet and onto the naked earth. He thought he was going to puke himself, and he struggled with it, willing himself not to. He hated to puke worse than anything. And then he thought, but I was going back in there to fuck her, man. And everything came up in a loose rush, and he crawled away from the steaming mess, crying and hating the cruddy taste in his mouth and nose. He thought about her most of the morning. He felt a measure of relief that she had died. A great measure, actually. He would never tell anyone that. I ain't no nice guy, he said aloud. And having said it, he felt better. It became easier to tell the truth, and truth-telling was the most important thing. He had made an agreement with himself. No, he had made a sacred pact with himself that he was going to take care of her. Maybe he wasn't no nice guy, but he was no murderer either. And what he had done in the tunnel was pretty damn close to attempted murder. So he was going to take care of her. He wasn't going to shout at her no matter how pissed he got sometimes, like when she grabbed him with her patented Kansas City clutch as they mounted the Harley. He wasn't going to get mad, no matter how much she held him back or how stupid she could be about some things. The night before last, she had put a can of peas into the coals of their fire without ventilating the top, and he had fished it out all charred and swelled about 3 seconds before it would have gone off like a bomb, maybe blinding them with flying hooks of tin shrapnel. But had he read her out about it? No, he hadn't. He had made a light joke and passed it off. Same with the pills. He had figured the pills were her business. Maybe you should have discussed it with her. Maybe she wanted you to. It wasn't a friggin' encounter session, he said aloud. It was survival, and she hadn't been able to cut it. Maybe she had known it too. Maybe shit, Larry said angrily. He tipped the canteen up to his mouth, but it was empty, and he still had that slimy taste in his mouth. Maybe there were people like her all over the country. The flu didn't just leave survivor types. Why the hell should it? There might be a young guy somewhere in the country right now, perfect physical condition, immune to the flu, but dying of tonsillitis. Larry was sitting on a paved scenic turnout just off the highway. The view of Vermont marching away to New York in the golden morning haze was breathtaking. A sign announced that this was 12 Mile Point. Actually, Larry thought he could see a lot further than 12 miles. On a clear day, you could see forever. So why was he feeling so bad anyway? He was telling the truth, wasn't he? And the worst of the truth was that he felt relief, wasn't it? That the stone around his neck was gone. No, the worst is being alone. Being lonely. Corny, but true. He wanted someone to share this view with. Someone he could turn to and say with modest wit, "On a clear day, you can see forever." And the only company was in a tent a mile and a half back with a mouthful of green puke, getting stiff, drawing flies. Larry put his head on his knees and closed his eyes. He told himself he wouldn't cry. He hated to cry almost as bad as he hated to puke. In the end, he was chicken. He couldn't bury her. He summoned up the worst thoughts he could, maggots and beetles, the woodchucks that would smell her and come in for a munch, the unfairness of one human being leaving another like a candy wrapper or a discarded Pepsi can. But there also seemed to be something vaguely illegal about burying her, and to tell the truth, and he was telling the truth now, wasn't he? That was just a cheap rationalization. He could face going down to Bennington and breaking into the ever-popular hardware store, taking the ever-popular spade and a matching ever-popular pick. He could even face coming back up here where it was still and beautiful and digging the ever-popular grave near the ever-popular 12-mile point. But to go back into that tent, which would now smell very much like the comfort station on Transverse Number 1 in Central Park, where the ever-popular dark sweet treat would be sitting for eternity, and unzip her side of the sleeping bag the rest of the way and pull out her stiff and baggy body and drag it up to the hole by the armpits and tumble it in and then shovel the dirt over it, watching the earth patter on her white legs and stick in her hair. Uh-uh, buddy. Guess I'll sit this one out. If I'm a chicken, so be it. Plucka, plucka, plucka. He went back to where the tent was pitched and turned back the flap. He found a long stick. He took a deep breath of fresh air, held it, and hooked his clothes out with the stick. Backed away with them, put them on. Took another deep breath, held it, and used the stick to fish out his boots. He sat on a fallen tree and put them on, too. The smell was in his clothes. "Bullshit," he whispered. He could see her, half in and half out of the sleeping bag, her stiff hand held out and still curled around the pill bottle that was no longer there. Her half-lidded eyes seemed to be staring at him accusingly. Quickly, he used the stick to close the tent flap. But he could still smell her on him. So he made Bennington first stop after all, and in the Bennington men's shop he stripped off all his clothes and got new ones. 3 changes plus 4 pairs of socks and shorts. He even found a new pair of boots. Looking at himself in the 3-way mirror, he could see the empty store spread out behind him and the Harley leaning raffishly at the curb. "Sharp threads," he murmured. "Heavy, heavy." But there was no one to admire his taste. He left the store and gunned the Harley into life. He supposed he should stop at the hardware store and see if they had a tent and another sleeping bag, but all he wanted now was to get out of Bennington. He would stop further up the line. He looked up toward where the land made its slow rise as he guided the Harley out of town, and he could see 12-mile Point, but not where they had pitched the tent. That was really all for the best. It was... Larry looked back at the road, and terror jumped nimbly down his throat. An International Harvester pickup towing a horse trailer had swerved to avoid a car, and the horse trailer had overturned. He was going to drive the Harley right into it because he hadn't been looking where he was going. He turned hard right, his new boot dragging on the road, and he almost got around. But the left footrest clipped the trailer's rear bumper and yanked the bike out from under him. Larry came to rest on the highway's verge with a bone-rattling thump. The Harley chattered on for a moment behind him and then stalled out. "You all right?" he asked aloud. Thank God he'd only been doing 20 or so. Thank God Rita wasn't with him. She'd be bullshit out of her mind with hysterics. Of course, if Rita had been with him, he wouldn't have been looking up there in the first place. He would have been taking care of business so she wouldn't get any more scared than necessary. "I'm all right," he answered himself, but he still wasn't sure he was. He sat up. The quiet impressed itself upon him, as it did from time to time. It was so quiet that if you thought about it, you could go crazy. Even Rita bawling would have been a relief at this point. Everything seemed suddenly full of bright twinkles, and with sudden horror he thought he was going to pass out. He thought, "I really am hurt. In just a minute I'll feel it when the shock wears off. I'm cut bad or something, and who's going to put on a tourniquet?" But when the instant of faintness had passed, he looked at himself and thought he was probably all right. He had cut both hands, and his new pants had shredded away at the right knee. The knee was also cut. But they were just scrapes, and what the fuck was the big deal? Anybody could dump their cycle. It happens to everybody once in a while. But he knew what the big deal was. He could have hit his head the right way and fractured his skull, and he would have lain there in the hot sun until he died. He walked shakily over to the Harley and stood it up. It didn't seem to be damaged in any way, but it looked different. Before, it had been just a machine, a rather charming machine that could serve the dual purpose of transporting him and making him feel like James Dean or Jack Nicholson in Hell's Angels on Wheels. But now its chrome seemed to grin at him like a sideshow barker, seeming to invite him to step right up and see if he was man enough to ride the two-wheeled monster. It started on the third kick, and he putted out of Bennington at no more than walking speed. He was wearing bracelets of cold sweat on his arms, and suddenly he had never, no, never in his whole life, wanted so badly to see another human face.